newness of the new year. And for those hardworking ones that have been working for a long time, let's continue to be stronger this year because there's so much work to be done. The committee has an avalanche of work from the department, especially legislation this year. So we are going to be stronger. Today we are considering four items. We have pleasure to receive the public service commission, which is going to deal with the matters that we dealt with last time, but in a much more updated version. We also will drop to the bill that must go to the House, and after looking at what we have dealt with up to now, we will also deal with the briefing by the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. And the report on the results of the management assessment process that they promised us. And the last one will be and then we will adopt the minutes of the last meeting. I asked in somebody else, I said a good part in my ear that the DME has a policy then coming so that I can make one of the. We also welcome TMG, our usual observer, and we also welcome the Department of the Environment. Welcome. Thank you very much. The Department of the Environment. Yes, and Pumla, can you give us the director will give us the apologies.
Good morning, colleagues. And the apology that I have is from the minister and the teacher. Thank you very much.
We will now table the four copies of the report. There will be a short version of the report and the longer version, the one that's written draft for me. That one covers a summary of what we've done up to now. But for tabling in the House, we propose that we take the shorter version, the one with a smaller number of pages. We also have supplied you with the final draft of the special special training in the youth management team. We also have given you the set of amendments that have been detected on the board. If everybody's got a copy in person or has some. It has been circulated to be sent electronically to all members. Yeah, those that have showed me the fact that it's too good for them with broad copies here. Has everybody put a copy? Yeah, that's a longer version, my God. Say the shorter one. Amendment We've sent the two copies, one longer version of the summary of the report and a smaller one. So we know now that members have had the copies with them. What we want to do today, in order for us to be able to adopt the report and the bill, is to check whether members have seen the copies. Because PUMA is going to do what we normally do in this committee, read to you. So that those who are happy with what they have read, then that will be fine. And those that are not clear, then can have an opportunity to ask questions. Ndale mafanya, hapa se wafunde la wantu. Kwa wantu wabuchu ndo wafundi nipsu. Wafunde ifesi nisashuku. So uma kwa wafunde, angisa wafunde. Kabumtu, angazandi ya zandi bol. Ata kanya ni mwuzi wa ekona kwa sana nito. Kainti nisa lana. Okay, Secretary will read the shorter version.
Thank you, Chair. The portfolio committee on rural development and land reform, having considered the subject of special planning and land use management bill D14-2012, National Assembly, Section 76(1), referred to it and classified by the joint hacking mechanism as a Section 71 bill, reports the bill with amendment D14-2012. The committee reports the bill further as follows. The Social Planning and Land Use Management Bill B14-2012 was referred to the Portfolio Committee on Rural Development and Land Reform on the 18th June 2012. Subsequently, the committee invited members of the public to make written and moral submissions about the bill. On the 21st and 22nd August 2012, the committee conducted public hearings in Parliament where it heard oral presentations from 32 organizations that responded to the call for comments by members of the public. The submissions raised, amongst others, the constitutionality of the bill in relation to the conceptual understanding of the national interest and provincial powers in relation to spatial plans and land use management. SPLAM is a national framework legislation to address the fragmented, unequal, and incoherent spatial planning and land use management systems which exist in South Africa. Therefore, it would not be prescriptive by allowing the province to develop own legislation to regulate planning, taking into account their own peculiarities. Drawing on the proceedings of the public hearing, the committee identified the following key issues for further engagement and deliberation: the constitutionality of the bill, public participation in preparation and development of spatial development frameworks and land use rules, transitional arrangements, institutions and processes for appeal, delineation of powers and functions, national in brackets, national interest and provincial powers in relation to municipal planning, time frame for consideration of the development application, lack of consultation with the House of Traditional Leaders, deliberations. The processing of the bill involved deliberations as well as discussions with the department and state law advisors and reading the bill clause by clause. The committee sought independent legal opinion on the constitutionality of the bill. Advocate A. Aljami was appointed by the committee. The committee expected the parliament as argued by the Speaker of the National Assembly during the 2012 budget vote debate for parliament. The Speaker called on parliament to build up capacity in committees to ensure that legislation coming out of parliament can stand the constitutionality and scrutiny. Conclusions and recommendations. After extensive deliberation on the bill, the committee, together with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, State Advisor and Parliamentary Legal Advisor, agreed on the proposed amendments that informed the B version of the bill to be tabled in the National Assembly during the second reading of the bill. The committee recommends that the National Assembly adopt a Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Bill, B14B2012, reported to be considered. Thank you very much.
Honourable members, are there any parts or the whole of the report that does not reflect both in the letter and spirit of what is going through this committee? Yes, naturally.
Chairperson, I'm happy that the report reflects in brief what happened in the committee, but there are a couple of grammatical and other changes that need to be considered to improve the report in some way. Chair, on point 1.3, in the third sentence, I believe we should say, which currently exists in South Africa. In the next line, where it says legislation, it should be legislation without the S. Chain 1.4, the second bullet, public participation in preparation and development of spatial development frameworks and land use schemes, not the land use schemes. Second last bullet at the bottom of the page, outgrounds for consideration of development applications, not that development applications. 2.2, the last sentence, Chair, coming out of Parliament can stand constitutional scrutiny. What is that?
Other than that, the difference between this one and the other one that you've already got. Okay. That's right. Thank you very much. Now I put the report. Agreed? That's Mr. Mazila.
President, I move that we adopt the report with the amendment.
Thank you very much. Before we started this meeting, there was a complaint that the last sentence, the last bullet point on page one is not complete because the way individual and traditional comes from, but it made some inputs or submissions, and yet we did not reflect that because we just focused on the house. And the real reason why we're focusing on the housing society is because of the legal requirement, not necessarily listing every submission that you need to do. So the sentence is complete, it's not incomplete.
Perhaps, Chairperson, if we may just add that, remember the department said that maybe the qualification should also be lack of formal consultation. Because the department did say that the brief to be the house, so it was not a formal consultation as expected. When it is naked and it is pretty bad. And in your normal report you do acknowledge that in the way you put it. The department, however, did say that they briefed the house. But the law requires that it must be a formal submission of the bill. So I'm suggesting that perhaps if you want to amend that to reflect accurately what happened, that if you don't object to that, somehow formulate it to reflect that perspective.
This is exactly why we gave you two versions. The longer version that seems to be the shorter version that only focuses on the subject.
Can we please, with you giving us a few indulgences, Chairperson, just to add one week, level formal consultation. I would imagine it would satisfy the committee's recognition that there wasn't formal consultation. It is technical but very politically important. But it's still the secretary objection.
The procedure allows me to requires me to go back to the mover of the motion and check whether the amendment would be accepted. Standard. You moved. Are you happy with the intention of formal, lack of formal consultation?
Yes, Chairperson, when looking at the detailed record, I think someone indicates that there was a consultation. I just think it was whether it's sufficient. I agree.
Okay, the second I agree to. Thank you very much. So we insert formal to recognize that some contact was done, although the law requires formal consultation. Thank you very much. So the report has been adopted. Now, normally the requirement is that we must adopt the bill as amended, and then this report will then go with that adoption for the house. I'm assuming that because we circulated the amended version of the bill with amendment, members are happy.
Can I ask a question about the long report, the comprehensive report? What is going to happen to that report? Because there are some problems with that report too. Just for us to file, we can file it for those problems. Otherwise, there's some issues in that report that need our attention.
We cannot file it with those issues. Also, the reason why it's a written draft is because it has to be adopted by the committee so that we can then put final after we have adopted it. We thought we should prioritize the one that is going to be tabled to the House, but members of the public, when they want to make reference to our report, will be reading the details and the summary. Go ahead.
Okay, I've got quite a few. I read this on the panel last night, so I haven't done all of them. I think there's two the ones that I have noticed. Chair, on page 2.4, the committee discussed the bill clause by clause, making proposals on sections and clauses, not clause, and clauses S that required amendment. Also, having deliberated upon the bill, and having produced a B list, the rest is fine until second last sentence of 2.4, vote, debate, comment for Parliament to build capacity within committees to produce quality legislation. And then 2.5, Chair, the opinion received from senior counsel raised a number of questions. So it should read, the opinion received from senior counsel raised a number of questions. And the last sentence, as well as some inconsistent and vague provisions. Chair, if I can continue on the next page at the top paragraph, the last sentence. The department in turn, instead of also, the department in turn sought legal opinion from Advocate Gauntlet. And we can't say Kaki, I'm not sure whether Kaki is an advocate or attorney. Okay, so we just say Advocate Gauntlet and Kaki. 3.1, Chair. The second sentence, let me read the whole first sentence. The bill, as discussed earlier, seeks to provide for a uniform and comprehensive framework for spatial planning and land use management for the Republic. Comprehensive framework rather than system for spatial planning and land use management. And then, Chair, the last paragraph in 3.1, this legislation, the last sentence, the last paragraph, this legislation will provide a national framework to prevent parallel planning mechanisms. Or I'll take mechanism off. The legislation will provide a national framework which prevents parallel planning. Chair, on the page 4, at the top, the paragraph where we've the sub-clause, the last line there says, of traditional counsel, not of a traditional counsel. In other words, it says the municipality in performance of the duties in terms of this chapter must allow the participation of traditional counsel. 3.4, the third sentence, Chair, starting with related to concerns. Chair. And then the sixth sentence, starting with committee. Committee took its cue from the Constitutional Court judgment. Took it to add it. And then, Chair, in the middle there, line 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Municipal planning should be taken by municipalities, hence an argument in the committee, not in my, just in the committee, that municipalities should be the first point of call for all development applications. The committee added clause 10.6, added to reinforce below. And then there where we say in the last sentence, the clause 10, we must put 10, bracket 6, insertion states the following. Okay, then 3.5, the committee, as well as many stakeholders. We've written the committee as was me, we should say the committee, as well as many stakeholders who made submissions to the committee, was concerned about the weaknesses of the bill. With respect to ensuring coordination and alignment of the different levels of planning at municipal, not at a municipal, provincial, national and regional levels. Chair, then page 5, the last sentence on the top doesn't make sense. The committee was of the view that SDS should comply with environmental legislation rather than not inconsistent. We need to fix that there. And then 3.7. The committee discussed at length the status of the SDF. A major concern was that the bill provide for a departure from the previous, from the provisions of the municipal SDF.
Why don't we finish that sentence by removing rather than non-inconsistent? Let's stop at environmental legislation. Our members here are the corrections. Do we see any further corrections?
Chair,
just, can we not rather look at the amendment itself, where the position comes from? Because then it means it is flawed here, it may also be flawed in the set of amendments to the PhD. This is welcome. There's a swim layer to Jahuzi. Jabong Woko. Stand it. Look at this clause for this PhD. It should be in there. The position that is read by Ms. William Mabila. On page 5. He says, I've said to 7.8 in the volume of it. 7.9, okay. So it means that the 8 above should be inspected and the 9 below should be inspected. Yes, Chief.
Thank you, Chief. Honourable Members, that is correct with regard to the reference in Clause 8, sub-Clause 8, but there's just another change there, Chief, that according to the A list, that in 10, on page 5 of the report, the last clause 10, it should read, an inspector may issue a compliance notice, then after that it should be inserted in the described form. In the described form.
My major issue is not the report, is whether the bill itself is written correctly or not. Is it?
Yes. We actually want just the report to reflect what's in the bill, Jefferson. So, the bill is correct.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's the
we
one
just want to line the report to the bill.
I'm not juggling among
yes.
them now,
yeah.
So I'm relying on
yes.
the people
yeah.
next to you.
Yeah. No, the honourable member was correct with regard to the change in sub-clause 8. But now 10, there's another change, and that comes after compliance notice, we insert the words in the prescribed form.
Thank you, Chief. Thank you very much. Okay. We want to know what you want. You want? Thank you. Any further? Yes, we will.
Under the very same page 9 and 10, the second line, a person in control of a private dwelling or dwelling. And on page 5.
Yeah, we found the private dwelling, yeah.
Yeah. And then on page 4. 3.5a. If I'm correct, a person has to read the national government, the provincial government, and the municipality.
So it's changing the A's to the V.
No, you can't do that, Chair. So we have one national government, so it's the national government. There are multiple provincial governments. Thanks, Chair. Chair, I see you've given a text to some of the other issues. 3.8, the third line, the sentence starting with, it is not a common knowledge, it is common knowledge that land administration. And then 3.9, the first sentence, it should be schemes at the end of the first sentence. Not scheme. The fourth sentence in the middle, official or any appointed person as an inspector to inspect compliance, not on compliance. Okay, on out. Chair, then on point page 12, second paragraph. An inspector who enters and searches any land or private dwelling under this section must conduct such search or seizure with strict regard for decency and order. Now, we've got to put with strict regard to the law.
And I remember the, we added that much, I remember, when we dealt with the clause. We have it like that in the clause itself. Because it was our insistence that it must be dealt with that way.
But decency and order can't trump law. Because who defines decency and order? If the law provides something different.
I know that. But maybe we should then go back to the bill itself. We've got a lot of lawyers today. No worries, don't worry, we will fix it. It'll be lovely because this commission is watching. The bill requires that we write the sentence in order. Now, the court says that. So we'll have to change the bill to say law. Ziyabuza kuwe ngalo mntu imbheka bheka nje.
Decency and order is like an elaboration of what the law says. But the law will probably say many more than just decency and order. It can always include qualifications of that itself. So we'll have to decide.
I'm not looking for an interpretation. I'm looking for what is in the bill itself. So that the report should reflect what is in the bill. The lawyers are lifting hands and putting them down again, lift them up and putting them down. Exactly. Yes, Chief.
Thank you, Chair. It's already included in the section, Chair. If you look at subclause 4, it says when an inspector contemplated in subsection 3 performs any function of an inspector in terms of this act, the inspector, for example, just lost...
I'm an inspector, man.
I've just lost my reference.
Chair, while they're looking there, can I just propose that must conduct that search and seizure with strict regard to lawful provisions, and then you can take on the truth. Decency and order and respect to rights and dignity and freedom, security and privacy, those are all the provisions.
Yes,
please.
Thank you, Chair.
You must recall, Honourable Felix, that the lawyers were talking about whether it's suitable for drafting or not. So that's why I'm going back to them. Yes, Chief.
Thank you. I think the committee deliberated on this issue with regard to the powers of inspectors and how it should be enforced. Basically what Clause 12 is saying, sub-clause 12 is saying that when an inspector enters and searches any land or private dwelling under the section for the purpose of investigation, for the purpose of non-compliance or compliance with the Act, the inspector must conduct the search and seizure with strict regard to decency and order, and furthermore with regard to such a person's right to dignity, freedom, security, and privacy. Chairperson, the clause as it stands now, for our purposes and for the law, the inspector will act within the framework of the applicable law and within the framework of the Constitution. So the person's right and the property owner's right will be respected, and the right to privacy, security, freedom, and dignity, those are fundamental rights and those are protected under this law. So it's not necessary to refer to a wording where the inspector must comply with in terms of the law. This, as it stands now, the wording is sufficient. It's also worded in respect of other laws where laws are enforced by inspectors, and so it's an acceptable wording as far as we are concerned. So it's not necessary to refer to that particular wording, Chair. Thank you.
Honourable friend, you will recall we had a long discussion on this matter and we settled for this way. Now Now, I do not want the lawyers to explain to us. I want us to agree whether the clause in this deed, as reflected, is acceptable to the committee or not. Yes.
Chair, I'm not going to flog a dead horse about this, but I just my concern then is why elaborate on some of the rights and freedoms when you could just simply say according to the precepts of the law? Because we're now elaborating on some of them, but not all of them. So are these the only ones that have come? That's my question. So, you know, if drafters say that's the way of drafting it, I'm going to flog a dead horse about it, but I just don't understand why we have to list some of the rights, preemptive rights and freedoms. But not all of it. I'm prepared to leave that here.
The prime mover of the motion is stepping down. So what do you want to enter the space?
I'm agreeing with you.
He has withdrawn the comment. So what is your problem?
No, Chairperson, I'm not having a problem. I'm just saying that guidance must always be that our law must be drafted free. And this is why elaboration is not necessary in many instances. I'm not saying that the law is
I rule you out of order. The real reason why I'm behaving like this, Chief, is that, you know, when we deliberated on this, especially in this clause, we argued about it. In fact, some of us were saying, that one of the reasons why inspectors go and search and seize is based on the reports that they would have about wrongdoings that are not compliant with town planning, municipal planning, in that property. So instead of going there and break the doors and all these other things, we must do it in a decent way. Because remember, this is not a police officer. This is an inspector. A policeman would know the procedure. But this one would not, so he must be guided, or she must be guided by what would guide him or her to go and search there. We then settled for that. Don't bring us back, please. And Honorable Tony is stepping down on the point. Does not want to flog a dead horse. Now why do you want to wake up the horse that's dead? Dead? Why would you shoot him when he's dead already? Thank you,
ma'am. Yes, Honourable Tony. Just a couple more. 3.11, the last paragraph.
Yes.
The assertion above established among development principles that the value of the property should not be the only deciding factor. We just need to change that wording around. Should not be the only deciding factor. And then in 3.3, Chair, on the fourth last sentence, starting with opinion. Opinion on the bill. And then, rather than opinion on bill, on the bill. And then, again, where we have advocate, Gauntlet, and Cartley, we should just put advocate, Gauntlet, and Cartley, or advocate, Gauntlet, and advocate, Cartley. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is the committee ready to adopt the report? Yes, we will be with it.
On page 3, the top paragraph, the second line, point 3, the content that some of the clauses required redrafting due to, I think we need to add to, and a move for adoption.
That amendment, then you move. Yes,
thank you, Chief. Just assist the committee with another correction on page 2, Chairperson, paragraph 2.4. The first sentence, you should read, the committee discussed the bill clause by clause, making proposals on clauses that require amendments, not on sections, because this is for the book. So, should rather refer to the committee discussed the book clause by clause, comma, making proposals, and we delete on sections, and just say clauses that require amendments.
Okay.
And then the last correction, Chairperson, having the second sentence, having deliberated on the bill and reducing the A list. The A list refers to the list of amendments, not the B list, the A list. The committee's still legal opinion. That's fine. Thank you.
Now, if you search for more, you definitely will find them. Now, let's rest at this point. There is a mover. Can we get a second? Hello, yes. And then we also have the
the director supporting the commission, Justice Kwedi. And next to Justice Kwedi, we have our parliamentary officer, Dr. Tiwe Mabaza. Chairperson, on behalf of the commission, we want to express our appreciation for having invited us to interact with this portfolio committee on the issue of the assessment of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform with respect to its compliance with the constitutional values as enshrined under Section 195, as well as briefing the committee on the progress which has been made in respect of those recommendations which were made by the Commission when it briefed the committee on the 14th of September 2011. As Chairperson, we want to express our appreciation of the fact that the committee has actually kept its promise to say that they wish to ensure the Commission that they take the recommendations that we are making, you know, very seriously. And the fact that part of our briefing is a follow-up to determine the extent to which those recommendations were made is quite heartening. It was at the heart of the work of the PSC, which is knowledge intensive, is to make recommendations. And the only way in which these recommendations can be meaningful and impact on service delivery or the improvement of performance is when those recommendations are taken very seriously by the portfolio committee, which has got a constitutional mandate to ensure that the executive actually carries out its responsibilities. In other words, to ensure to assist the portfolio committee in execution of its oversight function over the department and the executing authority. So in that context, we are very, very pleased. And I can assure you, Chairperson, of your committee, this for the first time with all the committees we've interacted with, that a follow-up is being made to see that the recommendations were actually been carried out. Chairperson, I just need to point out that now, in trying to make the question made on the commission, we need to point out that we normally don't assess all the departments, you know, every year. As you will appreciate the fact that the commission, the size of the commission and the resources, but what we normally do on a yearly basis, we take a sample of the department, 30% or so, we assess them. But what we try to do here as part of the brief is to get information on other sources of information to see the extent to which the department has actually complied with the values as established in the Constitution. We have also requested the department to conduct self-assessment, you know, and then provide us with information. And on the basis of their self-assessment, we're in a position to assess the extent to which they are complying with these consumer values, and then which is augmented by information as taken from other sources like the AG and other tools which we are using. But equally important, we've also made an attempt to assess the extent to which those recommendations which we made in 2011 have been implemented. And we think this week will be at a position at the end of this presentation to determine the extent to which progress is being made, what are the blockages, and what is the way forward. And in so doing, we believe that we'll be in a position to ensure that we're making progress. Without much ado, at this point in time, I will therefore ask the Director General, Professor Levine, just to take us through this presentation, and thereafter we'll engage in time of interaction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Honourable Members, Deputy Minister, chairperson, deputy chairperson, and commissioners of the Public Service Commission, colleagues, my colleagues at DG. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I was informed that there was a problem with the overhead projector, but assured that everyone has the presentation. So I think we'll just go on the basis that I'll be talking to the hard copy of the presentation, which I believe is in front of all honourable members. The outline really is we'll give a brief introduction. Most of it has been given already by the chairperson of the Commission. We'll talk briefly to the issue of the application of our M&E system. Then we'll look at the feedback we received from the department on the recommendations made by the PSC in 2011. And then we'll look at some key management areas related to the 9 constitutional values and principles of public administration in Chapter 10 of the Constitution, using, as the chairperson has indicated, other data sources. And one will explain more about that as we move through the presentation. On slide 3, as the chairperson has said, at a high level, the Commission is required by the Constitution to evaluate the extent to which values and principles governing public administration contained in Section 195 of the Constitution are adhered to. We have, therefore, developed an indicator-based tool that produces a summary assessment of the performance of a department against each of the 9 values and principles, which was applied to the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform in the 2010-11 cycle and presented, as the chairperson has indicated, in September 2011 to the Portfolio Committee. We have been requested to now do another presentation which would indicate the extent to which the recommendations made by the PSC during that evaluation have been implemented. As the chair has indicated on slide 4, it explains that we haven't reassessed the department since that assessment because we don't assess the department using that particular tool every year. But what we've done is we have developed another tool which Parliament will become more familiar with, and it's called the Public Service Barometer. And in the Public Service Barometer, we use official information, which we glean from annual reports, from PERSOL, from Auditor General reports, and all official information available, which would include official statistics from South Africa. So what we've done is, in this presentation, we look at the key recommendations which were made in 2011 and the department's response, which is essentially, as the chairperson has explained, the self-assessment by the department as to the extent of the implementation of those recommendations. And then we use our other tools to look at the same constitutional values and principles, using those other tools in order to assist the committee to make an assessment as to what the current status of the department is pertaining to the original issues that were highlighted in the 2011 report. During that particular cycle in 2010-11, we applied the tool, and on slide number 5, we give an indication of the scores which were awarded. And I'm sure during the discussion time, if there are concerns, which I kind of heard during the break period around some of those scores, then we would be in a position to respond and explain. But that is really an outline of the scores that were awarded during that particular evaluation cycle and the application to the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform. In slide 6, we begin to look at the self-assessment by the department as to the extent to which particular recommendations made have been followed through and intervening actions taken by the department to address the issues. So for example, the recommendation on the time taken to resolve cases, the recommendation was that the department should ensure that all disciplinary cases are finalized within 80 working days. And the progress in terms of feedback from the department was to enhance tracking of cases, and an electronic disciplinary tracking system has been developed. This will be ready for use by 1 April 2013, and monthly case review meetings take place to improve turnaround times. Now, we do delve back into that with updated statistics, so we'll come back to a more objective assessment, and we will also look at additional issues raised by the department pertaining to the current situation, because we have engaged with them around the current situation based on the application of our other data tools as well. On the group project management standards, the recommendation was the department should include a section in the land reform project plan which spells out the monitoring evaluation arrangements for the project. The department has indicated that a number of eminent governance documents were developed and implemented. There's also a draft guideline on monitoring evaluation at project level, and a number of evaluations have been conducted by the department. We will look at other kinds of indicators which I think will help the committee to look into the whole issue of project management, and we'll get to them in due course. The communication of administrative decisions, PIJAS communication of administrative decisions should indicate the opportunity to make representations, the right to appeal or review, the right to request reasons for decisions. Unfortunately, the feedback we got from the department on this issue of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act was given rather on the Promotion of Access to Information Act. So the response was not really appropriate for the recommendation, but anyway, it doesn't happen with the department. We still do need feedback on that particular aspect of PAJA. The implementation of the fraud prevention plan, we recommend that the department should determine its exact capacity requirements for the handling of the fraud cases and ensure that the necessary training in the handling of fraud cases is provided. And the department has indicated that there is a directorate for forensic audits and investigations in the Chief Directorate of Risk Management and the Directorate of Fraud Prevention. And posts are currently being filled and capacity upgraded through learnership programs. On the recommendation of the content of the departmental annual report, which the Commission recommended must fully comply with the requirements for annual reporting set out by the National Treasury and the DGSA, the department has indicated that it's taken into account the Treasury regulations and DPSA guideline in preparing the 11-12 annual report. On the time taken to fill a vacancy, the Commission recommended the department should review its processes for the filling of posts and put in place measures that will improve performance on the time spent to fill fund vacant posts. The department has responded and indicated that the recruitment and selection policy has been reviewed, HR delegations have been reviewed to empower line managers with decision-making powers, and has also pointed out that there are challenges with the verification of qualifications and confirmation from SAQA, which leads to delays in the time taken to fill a post. Now, there's a number of these recommendations which we will come back to in terms of the application of the tools, as we've indicated in the preamble to the presentation. But we also decided that there are other areas that it would be useful for the committee to look at, although we probably we assume that a lot of the areas the committee has been seized with already in its work and the oversight that it provides over the department. So moving on to slide 9, financial management. There is obviously a concern around the persistence of qualified audits. And in 11-12, the Auditor General found the department did not have adequate systems in place to maintain records for all state lands situated in the former Bantustan areas and so-called independent ones and self-governing territories in the immovable tangible capital asset register, and noted also the legal claims against the department amounting to 2.042 million are subject to the outcome of legal proceedings, and found that in respect of compliance with laws and regulations, the accounting officer did not take effective steps to prevent irregular as well as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Now, the department has indicated that it has a large property portfolio of about 28,000 land parcels amounting to about 13 million hectares, excluding land falling under the agricultural land holding account. And they've spoken to a number of properties, 132. Of those land parcels acquired through the Restitution of Land Rights Act, they've also indicated that these properties are temporarily held by the state due to instability within claimants groups, which rendered them incapable of taking transfer, and that the balance of land was inherited from the former Bantustans or homelands. At the same time, they indicate that significant progress has been made to consolidate the registers, including comparing data against these records and other government entities. The controls that are being put in place will also help to deal with these matters. So there are particular explanations which the department has offered. Most likely they've offered some of these explanations to the committee as well. But I think at the end of the day, what we're all interested in seeing is significant movement towards a clean audit. Now the next slide slide number 10, is a particular approach we've been adopting within the commission. And that is, it does relate to the recommendations we made around project management, to the extent that we want to see across the public service not only an ability to spend, but an ability to spend in relation to what is identified as objectives, outputs, and targets. In other words, we are interested looking at the information that is available to Treasury, to the Auditor General, and to us, in line with our mandate, efficiency and economy questions. What is the quality of the spend? Is the money being spent in terms of the objectives, outputs, and targets set by the department? So if we look at the percentage of budget spend, from 2010-11 to 2011-12, there certainly is an improvement in terms of the actual budget spend. And it is within the generally accepted margin of 2% set by the National Treasury. But the question we raise is, although almost the entire budget is spent, the achievement of predetermined outputs at 45%, although it is an improvement from 30% in the previous year, is still fairly low. Now, there are reasons for the underspend, which would include difficulties in filling professional posts, for example, surveyors, restitution process challenges such as community boundary disputes, and institutionalizing the comprehensive rural development plan and integration of infrastructure plan. The point is, though, and this is not a problem which is unique to this particular department, we do look at the picture across the public service, and if we look at the 10-11, because the Auditor General has not consolidated all the findings from 11-12 year. It's only at that point that we are able to apply the data for that financial year. But if we look at 10-11, the full public service, 148 departments, only 7% of departments achieved 80% of planned outputs. And that's the point. We want to see how much or what planned outputs were achieved. That's really what we're trying to look at in this slide. So, okay, the expenditure is there, but does the expenditure match what was planned? And this is something we have discussed with the Auditor General, what we are doing. The Auditor General does not have a problem with what we are doing, but we believe in terms of the constitutional values and principles around efficiency, economy, effective use of resources, this is an important level of analysis which we are engaging in. And what we are saying is, across the public service, there is a problem. It relates to planning capacity, really being able to accurately identify the outputs, set the targets properly, and then ensure that budget expenditure is in accordance with what is planned. And the picture across the service is problematic. But then there are departments which are doing well. So, for example, the Provincial Treasury in KwaZulu-Natal is the one department that achieved 100% of its planned output. So there are departments that are on top of what they're doing. So it is possible, and we are just encouraging departments to really look at this and to ensure that planning is not malicious compliance. We don't just do it because we must comply with the Treasury. We must put out an annual performance plan. It must reflect the strategy, articulate in the strategic plan. Yes, but in foremost, it must really contain outputs and targets that are realistic, that are well understood, and that can be achieved. And that's really what we're trying to ensure departments do by engaging in this level of analysis. So, in slide 11, there is a bit more a narrative around this. 15% improvement in performance against predetermined objectives from the 2010-11 financial year, which shows that there is movement in the right direction. But regard to reporting on performance information in 11-12, the AG found that 46% of the indicators were not well defined, in that clear, unambiguous data definitions were not available to allow for data to be collected consistently. 30% of the actual reported performance was not verifiable due to a lack of monitoring and review of the recording of actual achievements by senior management, and indicators and targets were not suitably developed. The AG mentioned internal control deficiencies in 11-12, but I think what is contained in this AG report is some clear pointers to the department, which are very important in terms of the areas they should be focusing on to ensure that their planning is in sync with their expenditure. And this is a problem. We can't have plans which don't talk to budgets and vice versa. We do need to get that synergy going, and hence our focus on this particular or this set of indicators in order to assess how we're doing as a public service globally, and obviously in this case as a particular department. Moving then on to development orientation, which is a critical constitutional value principle. The department did contribute to poverty reduction projects through the CRDP and the Land Redistribution for Agricultural Development Grant. 3,058 households through the CRDP were assisted with clean drinking water. 10,000 plus employment opportunities were created, and 3,819 beneficiaries in enterprise development were capacitated. The Land Redistribution for Agricultural Development Grant redistributed 392,850 hectares of strategically located land, which benefited at least 310 projects and 1,211 beneficiaries, and 277 farmers were capacitated through agricultural training programs. Now, obviously, these achievements need to be seen in the context of the scale of the problem which the department is facing in its efforts to resolve the land questions. There are 2,920 rural wards across the country and 6.5 million rural households with greater levels of poverty than their counterparts in the city. In 2011-12, the department profiled 57 wards and 97,577 households under its rural development program. And the cost per household of the department's interventions are quite high. And clearly, these are major challenging issues which are vexing the entire country. This is one of the major priority areas of government. But obviously, the challenge for the department is to look at how, within the resource envelope, there can be innovation which would begin to make the kind of scale impact that is required by the nature of the problem. Certainly not easy, but these would be some of the observations. And also to acknowledge that the Comprehensive Rural Development Program and the Recapitalization and Development Program are developing the programs and are integrating infrastructure plans across the sphere of government, deployment of new technologies, and engaging strategic partners, engaging with mentors, and clearly struggling in terms of ensuring that there is coordination across the country in terms of the key project and program objectives of the CRDP, trying to institutionalize it, bed it down, developing new administrative practices, and there is a hope and the belief on our side that if the department continually tests and improves its practices, it will become more effective in the future. But clearly, there is a lot of work still to be done. Moving then, Chairperson, onto slide 15, which talks to accountability areas. One of the things we look at in terms of accountability is the issue of performance management. It is a key mechanism of accountability across the entire system from the DG downwards. It gives us a sense of the extent to which performance management is rigorously implemented and the extent to which then we see the desired benefits, which is increase in performance and also the development of a performance culture across the public service. Now, what we're looking at in this little table here is submission of the performance agreement of the HOD by the due date. And obviously, what we're saying here is that in 11-12 it was submitted after the due date, but in 12-13 the performance agreement was submitted on time. We also indicate that the current HOD qualified for evaluation in the 11-12 financial year, but that no evaluation documentation has been submitted. Now, that's not a unique problem. We are grappling with that problem. It's a problem across the board in terms of submission of evaluation documentation, and the Commission has made recommendations to Cabinet on how to improve the situation, extend deadlines, and ensure that all documentation is submitted on time. And it is important to mention that in the individual complexities of these issues, one does have to look at the two-sided nature of the issue, and it is true that HODs in certain incidences do submit documentation, but the EA does not then finalize the process and forward it to the Commission. But we're not commenting on that issue right now, but saying that it takes two to dance this particular tango. But at the same time, we would like to applaud the fact that both the HOD and the EA reached agreement on the performance agreement, so that for the 12-13 financial year it was submitted timeously, and it is a positive example to the rest of the department, and hopefully it will cascade downwards in terms of the performance of the department as a whole and its management. Moving then on to professional ethics. What we can say here is that rooting out corruption and maladministration is fundamental, as we know. Internal audit in 11-12 were investigating 32 cases of alleged irregularities. The Special Investigation Unit investigated 36 cases of alleged irregularities in land reform projects in 11 and 12 financial year. 87 cases were referred from the National Anti-Corruption Hotline to the department. However, the feedback and closure rate in respect to the National Anti-Corruption Hotline cases as at December 2012 does require improvement. So 87 cases were referred. Feedback was received on 31%. 11% of cases were closed, and we had 77 outstanding cases. Now, basically, for a case to be closed, it has to be fully verified by the PSC, so at times departments will believe that they have completed the process, but the PSC will still need to verify. So the department has given feedback on the cases and indicated that 51 were finalized. 24 investigations were completed, 23 requests referred to other officers, 4 requests referred back to the PSC, 1 case was referred to a law enforcement agency, 26 were referred to the SIU, 5 are being investigated, and 4 requests have not been investigated. So in other words, in terms of us preparing for this meeting, we did receive further feedback, which we can take into account. But I think it's very important that we emphasize the need for cases to be, for us as a PSC to receive the feedback and then obviously look at, with the department based on the information received, the reports around the investigations being conducted, reach the point where we can actually verify that cases have been closed, people have been found guilty or not guilty, disciplinary action has been taken, or whatever is appropriate. Then to look just at the financial disclosure. Now, I think this is an area of concern, which we can't make sound good in any particular way. Because what we are doing as the PSC is we receive forms by a certain due deadline, which is the 31st of May every year. That is a basic compliance. And in the PSC, over the years, we come to believe that that basic compliance is so basic. It is simply filling a form and submitting it by the executive authority to the PSC. It's not saying what is in the form. We have now begun a process of scrutiny of the forms. We have started in previous years to look at a 30% sample of those submitted by the due date across different departments, national through to province. But from this year, we are scrutinizing each and every form which is submitted to the PSC to pick up potential conflicts of interest, tackle conflicts of interest, and cases where simply you have officials with large number of businesses. There are officials in the senior management service in government who are running 8-9 businesses. There may not be a conflict of interest, but the issue is, can they do their work if they have interest in that number of businesses? So what we're saying is, in terms of the due date, we really need to look at getting these forms in on time. Even if we look at compliance after the due date, which we don't really want to do because we believe that that basic compliance is not met, we shouldn't be looking at what gets submitted late because it's such a basic level of compliance. But in any event, there is an improvement if we look at what's submitted after the due date. But ultimately, let's look at that 99% for 11-12. Let's look at that being submitted by the due date in future. That's the plea we would like to make. In terms of the scrutiny on page, or slide 18, sorry. In terms of the scrutiny, we have picked up 42 cases of potential conflicts of interest in the 220 SMS in the department that we looked at, which is 21% potential conflicts of interest. And we feel that although this may not be high as the national average, national province, which is around 31%, it still is cause for concern. And we are hoping that the EA and the DG will look into these cases and take the necessary action which may be required, particularly if those potential cases of conflict of interest are actual. Now, if I may just point out for the benefit of the committee that with the 100% scrutiny, we've also strengthened the methodology. So in this particular sampling that you're looking at, we're simply taking the company register, the deeds register, we're looking at what's declared and we're checking against those databases. What we're doing from this year onwards is we're introducing the departmental supplier database as a third checking point, which will say the official has a company, yes, it's been disclosed, but the company appears or does not appear on the department's supplier database. And if it appears on the department's supplier database, then we believe we have an actual conflict of interest. So we believe the quality of the information we will bring to Parliament in future will be superior as well as the information that we will be giving to departments themselves, the EA and HOD. Now the next slide on 19, slide 19, deals with the management of precautionary suspension in cases of serious misconduct. And what we see is in 10-11 year, there were 3 people on suspension. The average number of days was 126. 11-12, there were 9 people on suspension. The average number of days, 270. And the costs, very high in the 11-12 financial year, 4.2 million, basically. We also saw that financial misconduct cases reported to the Commission revealed that in 9-10, 10-11, 11-12 financial years, the Department reported 5 cases each year. We do believe that the number of cases of financial misconduct is low, given the Auditor General's finding that the Department did not take effective steps to prevent irregular as well as fruitless and wasteful expenditure. And this table here just looks at the cost of financial misconduct, the amounts involved, the very high in 10-11. The amount recovered was nothing. So basically, we do have a situation where we believe that there should be more effective action taken in the area of financial misconduct, and the department does need to pursue some of these cases more relentlessly than it is currently doing. The department has indicated that they face capacity constraints in managing precautionary suspensions and misconduct, in managing discipline. There's also been inadequate reporting systems, which has led to inefficient monitoring and management of cases. At some of the hearings are causing delays because of the way in which they are managed. There are also structural difficulties between head office and the provinces in this particular area of work. So a clear reporting system has been put in place which allows for a strengthened monitoring and management of cases. The department now has a clear understanding of the number of outstanding cases, what actions are required in the cases of those cases. There's a monthly monitoring of the cases with progress reports forwarded to top management. And there's also now an electronic disciplinary tracking system mentioned in the beginning of the presentation under progress against the original recommendations by the Commission, and that this will be implemented from the new financial year by 1 April 2013. There's also targets which have been set for finalization of cases in the 12-13 operational plan, and these targets have been included in the performance agreement of staff. Compliance with the targets is being assessed. There's also been a reorganization of the labor relations unit. There's been better communications with the provinces to ensure that cases are reported timely. There's also been a disciplinary policy which has been developed, which will aid in the handling of disciplinary processes. The department is also now limiting the use of legal representatives to simplify the disciplinary processes and to prevent hearings from being unduly delayed. And this has led to an elimination of many of the backlog of cases, or many of the cases in the backlog, and measures have been put in place to finalize the outstanding cases. They also indicated that 30 employees have been disciplined for financial-related misconduct since April 2011, and that these transgressions range from fraud, bribery, contravention of the PFMA regulations, irregularities in supply chain processes, amongst others. There have been 14 dismissals, 7 final written warnings, 3 written warnings, and 2 suspensions without pay. And the number of precautionary suspensions has been reduced, and all appeal cases stemming from the previous financial years have been finalized. So this particular feedback in terms of the self-assessment around the latest data is promising, and we look forward to the next audit that we'll conduct to see the effect of all these measures taken. In the area of transparency, the department's website on slide 20 is user-friendly. Most documents are easily accessible. The manual on access information is easily accessible, and it's available in all official languages. The annual report is a key accountability mechanism, but it only serves to promote transparency if it is readily available. And the department's annual reports for previous financial years are available on its website. As on 31st January 2012, the 11-12 annual report was accessed to the government information website, but there's no link to the document on the department on website, and it's not uploaded to the website, so we would hope that this would happen, so that people out there who use these tools are able to, in the most easy and straightforward way, which would be the departmental website, access the website, and access the annual report via the website. In terms of good HR practices, we've looked at the vacancy rate as 31 March 2012, it was 11.4%, but it increased to over 18.5% in December 2012. The high vacancy rate was due to attrition and the stringent requirements for the filling of posts in occupational specific dispensations. And we also thought it would be useful just to point out that in the 11-12 financial year, 6% of the total budget, that's an amount of 496.3 million was spent on consultants for 48 different services. So basically, moving on to slide 22, we look at the whole issue of staff being held additional to the establishment, and we look at the public service regulations, which indicates that an executive authority may employ persons additional to the approved establishment where the incumbent of a post is expected to be absent for such a period that his or her duties cannot be performed by other personnel, a temporary increase in work, or if necessary for any other reason to temporarily increase the staff of the department. There is a high percentage of staff held additional to the establishment, which is linked to the implementation of a new structure, which does cause vacancy rates to go up, given the uncertainty when there is a restructuring process taking place. But I think we would also like to point out, and we use this indicator because the DPSA uses it as an indicator of good HR practice in some of its reports, is that contract appointments used strategically can be of benefit to the state in terms of savings, but also providing opportunity to access talent and potential without any commitment beyond a contractual obligation. So it can, if it's being used strategically, then we wouldn't necessarily have a problem, and it can have benefits because it allows the department to assess talent in a position, although it's additional to the establishment, and then later see whether there are suitable vacant posts where that talent could be recruited and absorbed on a permanent basis. In terms of the employment equity statistics, the constitutional value and principles related to representativity, basically, what we can see is that in terms of the target of black people, the target is exceeded. I'm not sure whether that's good or bad, but the target is exceeded. The target on women is not being achieved, 50%. What we can see is that we still had December 2012 around 38%, and in the area of disability, the target was hit, and then obviously people get poached or they move on. So we have fallen below the target level, and that's something for the department to take cognizance of. Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members, in conclusion, we certainly believe that colonial and apartheid land dispossession is a major underlying cause of poverty and inequality in South Africa, and that land reform cannot fail and rural development must not fail. It's absolutely fundamental to resolution of our triple challenges of poverty, unemployment, and social inequality. We do recognize that there are improvements in some of the values and principles, and the department has worked hard to overcome some of the original problems that we identified, but there are still areas of concern which we pointed to in this presentation. Obviously, the sustained failure to get a clean audit must be addressed. The performance management process requires urgent attention. We need to ensure that we have clear, unambiguous, and measurable indicators and appropriate management action on poor performance. We want to ensure that the budget spend is closely related to everything that we planned in terms of outputs and targets identified. We'd also like the department to more actively and aggressively manage its integrity system and follow up relentlessly on the closure of cases on corruption. In terms of the self-assessment, the latest one, and the feedback given, there are promising signs, but we want to see it bedded down in actual reports going forward. We recognize that the department is undertaking re-engineering to fast-track the implementation of its programs. However, we would like to point out that when we look at the public service, when we see institutions continuously restructuring themselves, it does have a negative impact on performance. And it diverts attention. So if process and the back office become focused, then we don't get the kind of delivery we want. Now, obviously, the intention of re-engineering and restructuring is to achieve that delivery, but we also recognize in the big scheme of things, with the changes in EAs and HODs, whether it's five-year intervals or whatever, it does have a destabilizing effect. And we're hoping that current transformation processes will be bedded down, completed, and that there will be the required stability so that we can see the benefits, which ultimately is in service delivery to the citizens and a serious inroad into the challenges of land reform in this 100th year since the Land Act was promulgated. We thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think at this point in time, we'll just open space for interaction. If there are any comments or questions, we'll gladly entertain over to you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, here is an opportunity. Honourable members, put the gauntlet, thrown the gauntlet and asking for interaction, engagement. Perhaps I see the two ends.
I think my question is already trying to gain clarity because seemingly there's a lack of clarity in terms of accountability. Just trying to get to the slide of funds that have been received. It's slide 19, where it talks about the amounts that have been recovered and the fund amounts that have not been recovered. But my question poses to, if we are fighting fraud and corruption, why aren't people arrested? Why aren't people given the full length of the law? We seem to be talking of suspension and not really getting on top of clearing the penalty. So I'd like to get an understanding why is it not fully implemented. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a few comments and a couple of questions, if I may. First of all, Chair, I think it's encouraging that the PSC says that this is the first time that there's been a follow-up on recommendations of the department, because if you follow up and you do an assessment of what the department does according to your recommendations, then there actually becomes a consequence to what you say, and then it can start improving the system. So I'd like to commend both the PSC and the department that we're having this process, but I'd like to highlight a couple of issues too. I looked at the figures recently in this report as percentages achieved by this department, and look at the average score, for example, on the values and principles of 74%. And I compare that to the outcomes of this department, the achievement of objectives at around about 45%. And Professor Levine uses the descriptive analogy of malicious compliance. Now, if your outcomes are ranging at around 40 to 45%, and the outcome target of the department are very modest, they're only just over 50%, and you're scoring at 74%, which is, you know, an exemption score, then there's a problem. There's a disconnect there that I'd like to hear the TSC talk on. Then when we talk about good project management, Chair, I wonder what the PSC has found with regard to the department's evaluation methodologies and models, and whether their evaluations of projects are done on, based on success and failure. Because if you look at the outcomes again, the percentage of 45%, we have to regard that as failure, and if you go and have a look on the ground at land reform projects, you will encounter failure more often than not. So I just want to know what kind of methodology the department or the PSC is using to assess that. So I'm concerned that there's a huge vacancy of posts, and instead of getting less, there are more vacancies now, and I wonder whether there's a process of doing of retention and attraction, and whether there are exit interviews of people who do leave the department, because if you're continuously filling posts and training, you create an elevated risk environment in a department, a risk for fraud, and there is a propensity in the department for fraud with the financial disclosures that the PSC spoke about. So if you're having a continual turnover of staff, that is even more risky. Chair, I don't know how long we're going to talk in this department about a credible state land audit, comprehensive, credible state land audit, but in that regard, there's very little credibility with regard to progress, and I'd like to hear the PSC on what they propose can be done in order to achieve finality on a state land audit. I mean, you can use any number of methodologies, wind deed or any switches to verify which land belongs to the state and how much land the state actually does have. Chair, there's concern around CRDP, and the PSC quite rightly fixed it up, and it says one of the main projects around problems around success or success in the CRDP program is the institutionalization. Now, I don't understand what that actually means, but I'd like to know what institutionalization issues compromise performance in the CRDP program. Chair, value for money in the CRDP program must be a concern for the PSC, as it is for me, because if you look at the actual numbers of households and people that have become benefited from this project, compared to the amount of money that's been invested, we really do have to start looking at value for money or returns for rent invested. Chair, with regard to the HOD's performance agreement being handed in on time, I'm very pleased that 2012-2013 has been compliant, but if the HOD is not compliant, it's hardly likely that other SMSs are going to be compliant. So it worried me that Professor Levine said, he qualified it by saying that this is not a unique situation. As far as I'm concerned, those kind of qualifications militate against compliance. You either comply or you don't comply. You sign your performance agreement, it must be tabled, and if it's the executing authority that's responsible for the performance agreement not being where it should be on time, then there must be a consequence there. It's executing authority as well. You can't just tell HODs that they must comply and executing authorities don't comply. Chair, then with regard to late submissions, I concur with the PSC. Late submissions shouldn't be entertained with regard to financial disclosures, because late submissions cannot represent compliance. And I'm very pleased that the forms are now going to be scrutinised and not just tabled on time. So then lastly, I want to just make mention of the concluding remarks. That firstly, in this year, 2013, the centenary commemoration of the 1930 Land Act, that land reform cannot fail. It's going to take more than making statements like that. Land reform is failing. It's failing because of these targets and figures that we've seen here. It's failing because on the ground, officials are not being held to account and that we're not getting value for money. And I'd like to know, when will we get to a point where we'll actually assess the outcomes of the land we spend on land reform? And when will we know how much land has actually been acquired and transferred in the absence of all the other issues we spoke about? Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. And also thank you for the report. Mine is just the one concern on page 8 around the challenges with the verification of qualification, as it takes longer than the norm to obtain confirmation from the SAQA. Is there anything that can be done about that? What does longer mean? Does it mean a year, 2 years, and so on? Because that's also another problem. You do have the credit, and do you have all the certificates and so on? Now you have to wait for a long time. What is longer, or is there anything that can be done to speed up also the qualifications authority to make things easier and very much safer? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me just thank Professor Levin for the presentation. Chair, I've got a few questions. Number one, on the employment equity. As you have said that the target of 2% has not yet been achieved, but the reason that you forwarded, you have said that people have been pushed. So it's got a problem that only people with disabilities that have been pushed by other departments, because really if the department is failing to meet their 2% target, I think that is a serious concern, irrespective of whatever reason that has been given. Then the other one, the use of consulting. According to your own assessment, is there any value for money? If 48 different consultants have been used for 48 different services. Then the other one is on the amount that has been recovered. Because when looking at 2010, 2011, out of 102 million, nothing has been recovered. Then and also when looking at the other figures, the recovery rate is very low. Then what intervention can we make to make sure that we really recover the money that has been, you know, that has been lost through irregular expenditure, for less than wasteful expenditure? Then, on the issue of the professional ethics, but on the financial disclosure, what intervention is PSC making if maybe these people are being too disclosed? Because at 99%, it's better being at 100%. Do you have power to act if people are failing to comply? Then on the issue of the cases, you know, when looking at the outstanding cases, there are lots of outstanding cases, which is an indication that the processing of these cases is very slow. Any assistance that's been provided to the department or intervention at PSC to make sure that these outstanding cases are being factored. Then somewhere on the development orientation, you mentioned that the cost per household of the department interventions are also high. Can you make some highlights? How much is being spent maybe per household? Then the last one, Chair, is on the expenditure versus performance. the job of institutionalizing the CRDP plan. Can you unpack this? Just to simplify it, what does it mean? Then, after the Auditor General has made has audited the financial statements and made some findings on matters of emphasis, what is the role of the PSC thereafter? Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. Quite a number of issues which have been raised here. Just to start the ball rolling, I'll just to respond to some of the issues raised here. Firstly, there is a very important question raised here regarding the issue of not actually why there are no consequences regarding this financial mismanagement or people involved in fraud. I think that concern, we also share that concern, and we think it is very, very important that there must be consequences. The unfortunate part is that we can give information to the department, and it is the department who actually have to institute those who to report those misdemeanors to the police. And I think if departments can do that, definitely there will be no need for this lengthy, disciplinary cases, some of them taking about 3 years and so on, when actually these issues should be reported to the relevant enforcement agencies. So I think the Honourable there is quite spot on this. It's a concern which we have raised in other contexts, and we think that it will be appropriate that action is taken.
I've heard that Professor Levin did indicate that yours is purely to make recommendations. If you make recommendations and no action is taken, are your hands so tired as that you can't do anything?
Yeah, I was about to respond to that. Actually, this has been a serious concern since the inception of the PSC in 1999. Now, having seen that now, in terms of the current legislative framework, the Public Service Commission Act, our mandate is simple: to advise, to make recommendations to the department, and we rely on the department to actually implement those recommendations. That's why, if you were listening, I mean from my opening remarks, I do appreciate the fact that now when we make recommendations, and the portfolio committee take those recommendations very seriously, it gives us pleasure because it means that something is being done. Now, to do something around this issue of not implementing recommendations, we have decided to amend the current Public Service Commission Act to provide for enforcement. And if now these recommendations are not being implemented, then we can have recourse. Some of them can become even a criminal act. It is an issue which is now under discussion, and we are actually consulting with the relevant key role players, and we hope that this portfolio committee, when ultimately this amendment is brought to Parliament, it will receive support, because we think that will be very, very important. It will give the PSC a test, so that now, when actually we make those recommendations, that it is very, very serious. also, but unfortunately currently we can only make advice and make a recommendation. Yeah, and then another area which I think I need to comment on raised by the Honourable around the 74% in terms of assessment, where actually suggests that there's a disconnect between what we're allocating and what is actually happening. I think that it's also an appropriate concern. The portfolio committee also raised this issue of a simple compliance, and we accepted the fact that now, when the instrument that we're using to us, the M&E system which we're using since its inception in 2001 or 2000, thereabout, was more compliance, you know, driven rather than outcome driven. But then now, around about 2010-2011, we started the process of reviewing this tool so that now we're able not only just to look at compliance, you know, but also to try and look at outcomes. That is a process which was completed, and I'm sure last year we'll be implementing it, and I think with the revision of the instrument, we'll be able to address some of the shortcomings in the methodology. Especially a relook into certain indicators. Well, that still depends on the type of indicators which are there. Some of them are high level, and you focus on a particular indicator, and not necessarily which covers quite a number of areas. So the review of the indicators will also assist in trying to bring about a balance between compliance as well as outcome. You will recall that some time back there was a problem with the purely basic administration, and hence the focus was on compliance. But we think with the current, you know, administration since 2009, a focus on outcomes, you know, orientated the 12 outcomes, we think it will be proper that we actually look into that. But we must also point out that this is not the only instrument we're using to assess, you know, the department. Because the nine principles are very broadly is one but one instrument. But we also assess progress. We also assess performance. So there are multiplicity of instruments that are intended to assess performance broadly. So this is but one of them. But the disadvantage is that now if you look at this broad 74% particular, you know, values and principles, you may be tempted to say that, but how can 74% when all the young people are actually complaining? So we take note of that, and we think we need to actually balance it by putting out other issues, other instruments. Another area I just briefly to point out, HOD evaluation, similarly here, complies with both the HOD as well as the executing authority. We will fully agree with that. And also the very same issue that now, strictly speaking, the Public Service Commission has got no, you know, oversight, you know, responsibility or the executing authority, but over the department. Now, once supply information to the Portfolio Commission, we think therefore their constitutional responsibility to use this information, and then to hold the executing authority accountable. I think I'll end there so that my colleagues can also fit in there, and then we'll also allow the PG to respond to some of the technical issues in the program. Thank you.
Through you, just to supplement what the chairperson has said in relation to the monitoring and evaluation tool. If you go back to the slide that you referred to, Honourable Member, slide number 5, 74% relates to the aggregate of the 9 constitutional values and principles, but issues of the effective and economic and efficient use of resources is at principle number two. But if you look at principle number two, it does correlate with the picture that you see of high spending as well as well as low achievement of stated objectives. I just wanted to supplement the chairperson's response on that one. But also when it comes to issues of accountability, what the Public Service Commission has really found very worrisome is the fact that on a five-yearly basis, politicians will go out and account to members of the public. But when it comes to holding heads of department accountable, there's no HOD evaluation. In a couple of weeks, you'll be dishing out billions that will be under the control of our accounting officer. But it's really very strange that portfolio committees, you know, do not assist the commission in making sure that heads of department do actually, after having spent the billions that you'll be allocating to the department, when they've spent the money, you need to assist the commission to make sure that at the end of the day they account, and the one mechanism of accountability that's at the disposal of the commission is the mechanism of HOD evaluation. Thank you.
Well, you share just one issue, and I need to end off. The PSC undertook a sample in different provinces to look at what departments are doing with regard to the recovering of monies that were in terms of financial misconduct. There is an act, it just escapes my mind, but what it really says is that if a financial misconduct has been in existence for 3 years, then that money, that case can be sort of written off, that money can be written off. I think that is where the problem is. Basically, in my province, we discovered that most of the cases of the monies that were not recovered were simply because they were over a three-year period. And for us, the most important thing is the employment issues and performance issues are dealt with by HODs are dealt with mostly by EAs. And our recommendations are precisely to EAs to say, take action against this head of department because of the following issues. And that never comes to pass to a large extent. And as the DC said, we really don't have any jurisdiction over the extra large extent. But I must indicate part of the powers that we have are giving directions with regard to promotions, transfers, and appointments. Then we can give directions which are binding to EAs. That is where our strength lies, but it only concerns those areas. And as the chair said, we really would need your support for the mooted amendments to the Public Service Commission Act, which would give more strength to us to deal decisively with issues of financial misconduct. There, for example, we could be able to give clear directions to departments or EAs with regards to financial misconduct cases. And just to close off the issue of sometimes HOD is not reporting officials according to law, because you know that any financial misconduct over 100,000 rand must be reported to the SAPS. This is not what is happening in any cases. And perhaps that amendment will assist us to step in there and make sure that it happens. Thanks.
Chairperson, thank you very much. I think this point was raised by Honorable Troy. Sometimes the late filing of performance agreements by HODs is not their fault. They sign their performance agreement, submit them to their relative authorities, and that's where they get stuck. that you pick up when you ultimately receive them. Sometimes you see that the HOD signed in April, and the executive authority only signs in September, which means that for that period, this document has been with the executive authority. And the point that the chairperson has made, we have no authority of oversight over the executive. Somebody else has to do that, maybe, with the amendment of the act, then we might, you know. And secondly, chairperson, in terms of the monies that get lost from the department, either through corruption or whatever, the department, and when I talk department here, I talk the HOD. In terms of the BMMA, the HOD has got a responsibility to recover those monies from whoever, let me use this one, stole the money. But sometimes nothing happens. And when we check, what have you done to recover money? Some will tell you, no, the pension fund is refusing to deduct this money from the pension of this guy who has left the department. And I don't think that excuse is really a valid excuse. I mean, pension fund, it is not your responsibility, in our view, to recover those monies, but rather it is the responsibility of the HOD who has to recover the money. Thank you.
Just a little bit. I'm fascinated by this performance agreement issue. For us, we did receive a report here, it was last year, when we dealt with the issue of bonuses paid to senior managers. When we looked at this report, it did indicate that some of the senior managers didn't have any performance agreements with their seniors. And we were asking a question, on what basis is the bonus given to this particular individual when there's no performance agreement with him? It's like a person here is on a temporary employment or free will, just doing as they please. And how do you measure then the qualification for performance, for performance bonus when there's no performance agreement? It is a worrisome part. But I'm also fascinated by the fact that we never know until we get the report. I'm talking about the portfolio committee. Until we get at the tail end the report. There has to be some way where we must know by which is the due date and whether it has been submitted and whether the executive authority has actually applied its mind to it and appended the signature. Because if we don't do that, we will be completely to the problem ourselves. And negligence is a very serious offense when you're serving the people. Chairperson, to you, I know that Professor Levine is now going to be dealing with what Chairperson calls technical issues.
Yeah, not 100%. At times it's very difficult to say this technical issues, what policy, you know. Yeah. Just to add on, to respond very briefly on the bond deliveries, the issue of performance management system in the public service is a matter of great concern to us. And I think one of the key areas that need added attention, as we've alerted to the cabinet last quarter, last week Friday, etc. But back to the quality of rates, what we normally do, once PAs have been sent to the commission, we can check their quality, etc. And then once that has been done, we then compile a report to indicate which department have submitted and which department have not submitted. For example, last year we did compile a report and then we presented it to the Portfolio Committee on Public Service and Administration. I think the point that we're raising, which is very, very important, perhaps we need to get a mechanism where this report should actually
not only be given to one portfolio committee, but to a number of committees right now, at least you have got that information, and you get it timely, because if you don't know it, and then now you have this strange thing of somebody getting a performance bonus. And I think that's another weakness with the current system of performance management, where you are having an instrument which simultaneously wish to achieve, you know, summative goals as well as developmental goals, that is now accountability and as well as a deep one of development. When I will have that now for progress to get this increment progressive pay as well as the bonuses. The emphasis is this right now, once you have that, you find that now more often than not, people does not review throughout the whole year. They're supposed to be 3 or 4 reviews. The only contract is in after the year. For the purpose of a bonus, for the purpose of progression pay. And it doesn't have any other purpose of whether the target, you know, the output plan in the first plan are actually being achieved. So we are spot on that. It's an area which we think we need to intervene and conduct more extensive a report. That has been reported by the PSC, as far as I can recall, as 2000 in the state of the public service. Reported on that. He received extensive coverage where officials get bonuses and pay progression, but actually no assessment was done. So I think it's an area of grave concern, and we share with that.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. On the issue of implementation of misconduct proceedings, which I think comes up as a theme in a number of the questions, the issue of consequences relates also to the issue of consequence, which the Commission as the Chair and other Commissioners have pointed out are very, very concerned with. The national average in 2011 was only 26% of departments are able to process their cases within the 60-day period. So it means the majority of departments have people on precautionary suspension for longer than 60 days. It doesn't really justify anything in the case of the department that you're concerned with, but we're looking at a major problem. And it comes back, it feeds back into the performance thing. Some of us never thought we had become bureaucrats, but some of us have been here for longer than 15 years. And, you know, we manage to sit and talk, whether it's in a formal performance meeting, a formal management meeting, they lament about the poor quality of work, about the fact that things are being done. But then one wonders what happens in those individual interactions. So easy to sit amongst your peers and complain and talk. But when it comes to consequences around misconduct, and we're looking here at millions of rand, the lack of consequence is a major concern. And what are the reasons? They may differ in provincial level, they may choose a kinship or whatever. Whatever it is, whether it's managers can't make that transition to action, it's an area that is simply not working in the public service. And certainly one of the ideas that I'm thinking of, I haven't even really floated it with the commission, but certainly at the level of DGs, public administration is decentralized, so everything goes down to a department. But maybe in the case of managing misconduct, there would be a strong case to have a more centralized approach. However, it becomes institutionalized, so that we deal decisively with this matter, because it's not being dealt with at departmental level. And even the systems are cumbersome, they're burdensome. You know, there isn't that internal capacity. One has to access people to chair sessions. One has to access people to lead the case on behalf of the department. These are not legal people. We want to, as experienced as this department is, we don't want to push everything into a legal framework with lawyers and court-like proceedings. We want to keep it at an administrative level, and the capacity is simply not there. Can we not look at maybe centralizing some capacity and just dealing with these issues. This is some of the things we're thinking about, or what I'm thinking about. We've spoken with one of the other DGs, and I'm sure the Commission will be amenable to these kind of discussions as well. Honorable Trollope has raised, I think, important questions which could become challenges to us going forward in terms of our scoring and rating systems on our different, on our different systems. You see, what we're trying to do at one level with this system, much of the new assessment is based on, as I've indicated, the public service barometer, the state of the public service barometer. We're using official information. We're not harassing departments. We see that the MPAT, the Management Performance Assessment tool, will not be discussed by DPLE, but maybe at some point it will. You see, that is a very big challenge for departments. I'm not saying it's wrong, but it imposes a massive burden on departments. Departments then have to start developing capacity to comply with the MPAT. The tool we use in the second part of our presentation is all in our back office, where we're analyzing official information. Department's information, their annual report, their personal information, of course, that's the South Africa data. And on the basis of that, we make an assessment. So it's important that, I think it's an important thing with us looking in our own back office, that our scores kind of add up. I think that's an important point that has been made. Are the evaluation models of Department of Rural Development and Land Reform? Well, I think over the years there have been good evaluations which have been conducted by the department. But I think what we're really trying to point out when we look at the discrepancies between budget expenditure and the achievement of objectives and targets is there is a lack of inculcation of project management culture in the department, which is tying the management of projects together with the management of budgets. It's not unique, that doesn't make it right in this or any other case, but this is a major area of concern as we've pointed out. We take note of the issue that a high vacancy rate in a department with a propensity for fraud is a major area of risk, and I'm sure the department is aware of that, or hopefully, and it has taken cognizance of that. With respect to the issue of the land audit, we haven't really as a commission, applied ourselves to it. Obviously, this committee or any other committee of parliament can ask us to do specific things, and maybe in summing up, it would be important if there are any particular areas that the committee would like us to follow up further from the discussion. If they could be clearly noted, then we can make a follow-up and get back to parliament, even if it's in a written submission. The issue of institutionalization, seeing like a state is always about putting things into projects and programs and frameworks and institutionalization. A recent study on the land seizures in Zimbabwe, done by objective academics, they're not Zimbabweans, found that upward of 40% of land that was invaded was being effectively used without any state support or input. Now that says a lot about many different things. They're not purely technical either. But it says a lot. And many countries, South Africa, come with complex frameworks, pilots, which go on and on and on. So I guess that's what we're looking at, rightly or wrongly, is seeing like a state. Where's the framework? Where's the institutionalization so that it just rolls? And then that will impact on the value for money. I will ask my colleagues, Ms. Makenjwa and or Mr. Vanamereva, to comment on the issue of value for money and institutionalization issues and some of the issues that we may not be picking up on some of the more technical issues. On the SAPA, the self-assessment by the department indicates that SAPA takes a long time. We would obviously need to verify that objectively. And again, if that is a specific request, that is something we could look at, because SACWA might have a different view. We don't know. We would have to obviously verify from both sides. But that was based on the self-assessment in progress in that particular area by the department. I was imputing something that's not there in terms of poaching, but I think generally across the public service when it comes to disability targets, that is one of the problems, is that there is a kind of poaching across departments. It may not be specific to the challenges faced by the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform, but obviously it is an area of serious concern. We raised it. The issue of value for money with service providers, again, something we would need to look into specifically if that is required. And, you know, the issue of recovery must obviously be linked to the rigorous management of misconduct cases to finality, but also criminal action being taken where relevant. And at an aggregate level across the public service, we are concerned that there is not a high enough focus on criminalizing and taking criminal action where appropriate in the area of financial misconduct. On the disclosures, just to elaborate a bit on what the Commissioner has said, and following up on what Commissioner Helepi has said, we do want to look at, in the amendments, whether the Commission can issue directions on matters other than the personal practices that Commissioner Helepi spoke to. And those are contained in the proposed amendments. But what we're doing at the moment is we write a report to every executive authority, and certainly with the sampling of the scrutiny of the forms, we pick up things and we write to the executive authority, and we are currently compiling a report. It will be completed by the middle of this year, where we would be in a position to give feedback across the public service to the actions which executive authorities have taken arising out of our recommendations on financial disclosure. So that will be a very important report. But if through the amendments the powers are augmented, it may be an area where the Commission would want to issue directions, because there is safety compliance involved. I don't think the Commission would want to issue directions on a development-related matter. It would want to fall in line with the constitutional mandate proposed measures. Because it's not clear-cut. Where it's clear-cut compliance, the Commission would want to issue directions beyond the personnel practices currently allowed for. Well, I think if there was a specific request to the PSC from the department to assist us on some of its misconduct cases or challenges around that, we would try. We are an organization with limited resources. But we are an organization which also needs to respond to the requests of executive authorities, departments, parliament, etc. And then the role of the PSC post the Auditor General's report is that what we're indicating is that there are certain areas that we do follow up on, because we believe there are matters which are relevant in terms of the constitutional mandate of the Commission, efficiency, economy, effectiveness, accountability, which does require us to go into matters of financial management and to follow up issues, not duplicate what's been done by the Auditor General, but certainly to see whether measures have been taken to address problems raised by the Auditor General. So in cases we do the follow-up.
But I'm not sure if Mr. Matendra or Mr. Fananara would like to add anything on some of the specific aspects around value for money, institutionalization of the CRDP. On value for money, perhaps I can add to the issue in two ways. However, when we apply an instrument an indicator-based instrument like the like our M&E system. We are not going that deep into issues of value of money. We also have a component conducting programming variations. And in those types of variations, we can also address value of money. But just to sort of also add to the what has been discussed, a question was asked that we mention a number. Unfortunately, I don't have a number, the cost per household for CRDP from the top of my head. But it was raised in the presidency's, the DPME's midterm review of the outcome, that the cost is so high that if one wants to implement this program on scale, then that sort of cost per household will become prohibitive. So on the one hand, my answer is our M&E system doesn't go deep into value for money, and we do conduct programming variations to also address issues of value for money. On the other hand, to add to what DJ said around our barometer, there are quite a number of analysis that we could add to our barometer that would also answer value for money questions. And the data to do that is, in many instances, not in all instances, available from the official budget data. For instance, in the case of land reform, it would be possible to say what is the ratio of administrative cost to administer this program compared to the actual value delivered to a land reform beneficiary. One can also easily do that type of analysis with regard to the housing program. The budget distinguishes between the actual benefit going to the housing beneficiary and the apartments, in the case of housing, the 10 apartments overhead cost to administer or deliver that benefit to the individual. One can compare it to our medical schemes, not more than sort of 10% of the medical aids contributions go to admin, the rest go directly to the doctors, directly to the benefit to the of the member of the medical field. So that type of analysis we can add to our barometer that will in for many functions, not for all, also comment on the value for money issue. Then going to the institutionalization issue, I think the DJ has summed it up quite clearly that it is about systems, structures, processes, project management, practices, information system. And if one now asks the question, okay, there is a project monitoring system under development orientation in our instrument, we assess whether the basics of project monitoring is there. But now, why does that then not relate, translate into actual project performance? And we intend to sort of pursue some of these issues to do more in-depth studies of whether the institutionalization that we put on the ground is appropriate and is implemented in such a manner that it actually delivers results. So the whole design of that institutionalization should be appropriate for the problem that one wants to address, and the Commission would certainly do further work in this area.
Yes, thanks, Chairperson. Thanks, Mr. Van der Merwe. I think you've taken care of those two issues. I just want to make an addition. In fact, I was reminded by the DJ on the issue of verification of qualifications. The PSC has a couple of years ago conducted a study on the verification of qualifications where we engaged a sample of departments, but also we engaged institutions such as SACWA. I think the problem is twofold here. There are issues within SACWA itself in terms of capacity constraints, but also from the side of the department in terms of adhering to the standards in terms of the period and the turnaround time for receiving outcomes of verification of qualification. We're making quite a number of recommendations in that report, which we've also sent to SACWA to say that they must beef up their capacity, be able to assist departments, but also departments make sure that they send their request as early as possible so that there's no implication on the filling of the cases. The report was also done to the Council for Higher Education.
Thank you, Chair. Just two more things. You know, the issue of youth vacancy rates. Over the years, we've done M&E investigations in various departments. One thing that causes this is every time an EA comes into office, there's this so-called moratorium on posts. And when you really look at the logic behind the pushing of that moratorium, you never find out exactly what that is. And the effects are so long-term that by the time you get people to fill in those posts, the damage has been done already. The other issue, you know, with regard to these huge vacancy rates stems from the preliminary evidence that we got when we're looking at a project on delegations, HR delegations, and financial delegations to each heads of departments. We looked at the issue of what we may find as a discrepancy between the fact that the HR delegations are given to EAs, but financial delegations to HODs. Now, HR delegations have financial implications. And you know, perhaps, if I may call one of the HODs whom we interviewed, he said, you know, if I don't have HR delegations, it's like saying that I should be the coach of the national squad, but I shouldn't choose my players, but I'm supposed to win the tournament. So for me, that was a very significant statement. So that is why the issue of HR delegation is very crucial to civil slavery and for the stability of the public service everywhere in the world where you find stable public services. You realize that issues of HR are either centralized in public service commissions, as you know the old public service commission in South Africa was doing, or the powers are given to specific officials to exercise that stabilizes the public sector. The issue of the many reports that we wrote about the turnover rates, high turnover of HODs and the top echelons of staff in the public sector is precisely because of that. And the effects on service delivery are quite immeasurable. We need to deal with that. That is why we are coming up also, perhaps part of our recommendations would be that we should revisit the issue of HR delegations, especially with regard to what happens when the HOD says, you know, you win a tournament with a squad if you never filled it yourself, because it's based on your skills and your identification of what needs to be achieved. Now, the other issue is that of people with disabilities. In 2008, we went around departments, and we called departments and we said, why aren't you meeting the simple 2%, objective of employing people with disabilities? Because a lot of stuff. One, no, we can't find them. Secondly, if we find them, they are not well qualified. And no, we don't have a policy to deal with their training and development and so on. And can you remember when was this target put? It's more than 10 years ago. And I can assure you there's no purposive kind of strategy for departments to employ people with disabilities. It's by default. That is why the fluctuations in most, yes, they are being pushed, but in some instances, it's by default that they employ a person with disability. And I have seen departments which have gone high and all of a sudden they drop in 1 year. And when I go in there and say, guys, why this drop? They sometimes don't even know. They're not even aware that there's been a drop. So this issue needs great consideration. Coming back finally to the issue of moratoria, I sometimes wish that we could have a sort of guide to say under which circumstances can EA put a moratorium on
on the employment of people.
Because most of the time I ask, why is this happening? And have you looked at the possible consequences of putting this moratorium? How long is a moratorium? In which area are you putting? For example, the issue of also suspension. In one department in the Free State, which has about 10 SMS members, 6 were put on suspension. It literally, you know, paralyzed the department. And you don't understand sometimes the logic behind that. So and those issues are the issues that we really need to guide EAs on. And the PSC really has to tighten up. And we are considering coming up with very strong recommendations for policy changes and for legislative amendments in certain areas to deal specifically with these issues. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much to the PSC. Honourable members, ideally I would have asked the department to share with us their own gut feeling, just on the face of things. Also, I would have asked the members to make follow-up questions, but I'm looking at time now. Maybe what we need to do is to check what are those areas in the Public Service Commission recommendations that we want to pursue beyond this particular meeting. I know that other portfolio committees would want you to go to them because we share with them the privilege of having to meet you and come back to us. So they would wish to be like us. But to pursue this engagement between ourselves and yourself is important for us to have an understanding of the job we have to do, plus also our own interaction with the department. DM, I will not give you the opportunity. No, the Commissioner from Free State has spoken on your behalf. Maybe I will be unfair, you know. Honorable Tronic would remember I was put in this kind of situation in the past in my life, where somebody makes a public judgment against you without allowing you or affording you an opportunity to respond. I'd be willing, but please, you have very limited time. I know that you and your CFO there next to you are worried about the things that have been said here in your name. If you have anything to say, you can say it. If you don't, fine. Because your time will come.
Thank you, Chair. I was looking at my honorable deputy DA to represent us, since he's not saying anything. We would be happy to deal with the specific issues that the committee would like to follow up on, so we'll be guided by the committee. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate that. Yeah. Man of few words. Honourable Trump.
Chair, yeah. I'd like to second you to thank the DD for his response, because what I found interesting was Professor Levine said that if there were issues that we identified, that they could follow up, because that really is helpful for us. And I mean, already the issue around SACWA, it's clear that it's a generic issue. It's not an issue related to this department at all. And I made quite a comprehensive response, so I've written that down. But obviously you're dealing with that. But say, if I may, there are 3 issues that I think that the PSC could really help us on.
First of all,
the CRDP. We are a body that's responsible for oversight of government programs. There are lots of concerns that have been raised about CRDP, value for money, effectiveness, cost of rollout, etc. It would be helpful if the PSC could give us an in-depth understanding of what is constraining successful CRDP rollout. The other one, Chair, is the issue of the comprehensive state land audit. The department missed its own deadlines countless times. We need to understand why that happened. And then the third one, Chair, with regard to the Public Service Commission not having any authority over executive authority, we do have authority over executive authority. So we need to get those reports. If the executive authority is holding back performance or not signing documents, Chair, as a committee, we need it. So that could help us, and we can help each other get this thing done and improve delivery if we could just get those reports about non-compliance of executive authority. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Troy. Honourable members, want to add? None. Thank you very much. It would be appreciable, it would be appreciated, Honourable members of the DSC, if you were, because there is a wide range of issues relating to the consequences of financial misconduct. And for us, if the investigation could be placed on whether the investigation, because it is a non-action on the part of city management, maybe a reflection of their own personal weaknesses that the juniors are aware of. But it's very difficult for us to go and investigate that. We can have your investigation given producing a report. It will help us to understand why there is non-action in their So the issue about consequences, about action, not only just suspension, report, non-reporting to the police and so on, but the whole system around it is a problematic area for me. And I think the committee shares that concern. The second issue, the fourth issue, because I'm adding those other three. The fourth issue relates to, because the disclosure has already been covered by performance, isn't it? Will include the disclosure, or shall we include the disclosure in the consequences issue? Okay. Let me deal with the last issue then. We have dealt with the department. The DGE 2 years ago had 10% vacancy rate. The following year it was 11%. Now from your report, 18.5. And they said it is because there's a moratorium on employing people from outside. You have to employ people from inside. But another reason given today is that there is a restructuring going on, and therefore you cannot employ if there is a restructuring, because you may not know whether the new structure will produce redundancies or new. I understand that one. But if the institution is new, by the way, the department was created in 2009, but it was actually finalized, I think, in 2010. So to have to review the structure and restructure it again in 2012 may point at how you created it at the beginning. Can you check with for us and help us? What is the real reason for this? Because they say that when they did not spend money on salaries, they say it is a saving. But when they employ consultants, they say it's because of the vacancies. So it's like a chicken and an egg situation. Let's look at the total picture and say, what is it that is creating a problem? What did the general get to ask to say, we want to table the report, our investigation on this department, on the use of consultants, 500 million rand. Now, you hear the whole party that runs the state, or they run the government, talking about developmental state. You cannot create a developmental state if you run the state via consultant. If the department has a capacity to perform its own function. Now, if you leave vacancies and employ consultants and blame the vacancies for the employment of consultants, you really are working against the developmental state. Those are the ones that I thought we should, because you see the issue of consequences, fund, recovery of funds, the not reporting to the police, the vacancy rates and so on. All those are in one package, which you want us to we want you to help follow them up, and we will be glad if we meet again here in 3 months' time and look at 3 months. Because what did you tell us about your target of 6 months' time? What is that document you are producing, which you are targeting 6 months?
The
Baromi. Yeah. So if we meet before we get there, it will help us so that that Baromi tells us what direction we go. Thank you very much. Honourable members, this part of our agenda item is done. Unless somebody will die if we don't deal with the system. Because I have to deal with the mayor. Parliament is insisting that is a serious legal problem for us not to adopt our own minutes. How can we not have confidence in our own minutes? How is it possible? Honourable members, we gave you a set of minutes of the 29th of January 2013. We put those minutes in your computer. If you printed them and you read them, please give us an indication whether they are the true reflection of what we did on the day. Today by 6, by 7.
I'm glad.
I'm going to go to the hospital.